Welcome to this talk from the Canando Zen Meditation Center. Located in Mountain View, California, Canando's meditation practice is open to the public. For more information or to get in touch with us, you can visit our website at canando.org. That's K-A-N-N-O-N-D-O.org.
I'd like to talk about our practice tonight and some of the fundamental aspects of our practice. When we first come to practice, I think most of us feel that it could be a problem, big problem, this very unfamiliar spiritual way brought over from a different culture. We can feel that the practice could be a problem, even though we're drawn to it, because we recognize that we are going to have to adjust our life to accommodate to the practice, to accommodate to the schedule, to accommodate to the routines of our Sangha, to the Zen community, to accommodate our life to meetings. And we have to accommodate ourselves to sit in silence and be quiet for what seems like a very long time. And this is quite unusual for us these days. And so it's not unusual to feel that it's too big. This practice is asking too much of me. We may feel, oh, I don't have the time. It will interfere with my work. It will interfere with my family. And many people say, well, physically, it's very uncomfortable. I'm just not in favor of it. So there are a number of reasons why we may feel the practice is too difficult. But if we come to the practice with a feeling that we want to be totally involved in our life, we don't want to live superficially. If we feel that we want to live naturally, we want to live beyond what is convenient, we want to live beyond what is superficial, and we have a deep sense that we don't want to live our life just for the pleasures that it might give us, but maybe more important, if we come to the fact is because we want to feel connected. We don't want to feel separated. If we come to the practice with these kinds of motivations, then practice will be no problem, no matter how many adjustments we may have to make. If we come with these kinds of motivations, we will find that we have enthusiasm for the practice. The Buddha was very pragmatic, very down to earth, very realistic about the quality of his practice. There was no magic, and there was no mystery in what Buddha was doing. He simply wanted to learn how to live his life. He wanted to live according to the truth. So Buddhists, in his practice, he was very watchful. He kept his eye out for, I'll just call it the untruth. He kept an awareness for things that were being mistaken for the truth. In other words, he was concerned about the delusion that people have, the ignorance that people have about the true nature of the world we live in. he saw through his own experience and from his own observations that people could fall into delusion about the nature of material and mental objects in the world. And he determined that this delusion was the cause of people's suffering. This was the key element of his insight. So his practice and his mission in life, we might say, is to find a way to dissolve delusion. Now, when we say delusion or ignorance in Buddhism, it doesn't mean being dumb. It doesn't mean being unintelligent. In Buddhism, delusion means having a lack of insight into the true nature of things. And this insight, the Buddha concluded, was very necessary if we are going to live our life truthfully. Suzuki Roshi was a very good student when he was young. He studied the teachings from a very early age. He was ordained at a very early age, and he studied with a number of experienced and mature Soto Zen teachers. And he mastered the Buddha's teachings. But what he was mostly interested in was Buddha's attitude. Suzuki Roshi was concerned with what was the Buddha's motivation in doing what he did. Why did he live his life the way he did? Why did he teach the way he did? And there's a passage, a short passage in Zen Mind, Beginner's Mind, where Suzuki Roshi told us how he felt about Buddha's attitude. And I'll just read it for you. Suzuki Roshi said, Buddha was not interested in metaphysical theories of existence. He was more concerned with how he himself existed in this moment. How we become enlightened was his main interest. He wanted to find out how human beings develop ideal character and how sages in the past became sages. Our practice is based simply on what's going on right now. And that is how we act and think and feel in this immediate moment. Or in other words, how we respond, how we take in, how we tune in to what's happening right now. And of course, as we know, it has to start with keeping our mind on the present. That is the starting point for how we become Buddha. It's the starting point for how we express our inherent enlightenment. By keeping our mind on the present moment, we can let go of the busyness of the activity of the small mind. in order that we can express Buddha's activity. So our practice is about staying open to the mind's activity as it unfolds in the moment. The interest in our practice is about becoming aware of how the mind is doing. How is my mind doing right now? We take it seriously. Our practice is to take seriously how our mind is doing. We want to be aware of how we become sages and how we develop character. The fundamental emphasis of our practice, as we all know, is coming back to our breath. And by keeping our mind on this very simple activity, is how we keep our mind in the present moment. When we first start practice, this can be very difficult, can be very tricky, because it is impossible to keep our mind 100% in the present. Because as we know, the human mind is always working and it's always wandering. The mind is always looking for something to grasp, something to play with. Our mind can be like a curious kitten playing with shiny and fuzzy toys. And because desires are always arising, our mind is continually at risk for becoming attached to some material thing or attached to some emotional thing. That is what we call the activity of the small mind. And that results in a very limited way of seeing our life by always focusing on being attached to material or emotional things. And when we understand this tendency of our mind, it's important that we acknowledge it. We say to ourselves, oh, I see what my mind is doing. So it's necessary to acknowledge it and to accept what our mind does. But we don't need to worry about it or feel sorry that our mind wanders, or that we become attached. It's simply part of being human. Our best response to the desires that emerge in our mind is to have quiet determination, to make our best effort to stay present and allow our mind to be quiet so that it can release the grip of attachment. In our practice, we make an effort to bring our mind back to the present moment. But this effort is not a kind of discipline that we're forced to undergo. It is simply Buddha's effort. And when we first come to practice, it seems like a kind of forced mental exercise. And we push ourselves to bring the mind back to present. But what at first seems like a forced effort, with practice, it becomes natural. And it's by continuing this simple activity that we become a sage. So as we all know, anybody who's read anything about Dogen knows his famous saying about to study Buddhism is to study the self. And this, of course, is not an analytical or an intellectual study of ourself. It is not studying ourself as a separate observer. Dogen did not mean that we should analyze ourselves by studying ourselves. He meant we should experience ourselves in the midst of our activity. Experience ourselves in the midst of activity. Everyone, all of us, we all will have difficulties in our life. But even so, we should not give up our practice, even when times get tough. We should not give up our practice. Our effort is to develop character. So not giving up is the secret and the spirit of our practice. If we give up our practice because we are discouraged, or it's inconvenient, or it's uncomfortable, or we have to make adjustments, if we give up our effort, we will never be able to see beyond our small mind, and we will always be driven by desire. And this desire will lead to anxiety, competition, feelings of separation. So once we find this practice, it really is foolish to give up our effort. And as we continue our practice, we begin to see more and more the very nature of our foolishness. And we also begin to see how we can give up our foolishness. Or in other words, we may see our mind thinking, oh, you know, I can't make this effort because my life is so confusing and so difficult. When we see our mind telling itself that, we understand how it is that we magnify our difficulties and how we turn our difficulties into suffering. If we want to end suffering and we want to learn how to truly take care of difficulties, we have to make an effort to understand how the mind fools itself. This is an important point. It's the foundation of our practice. Buddhist teachings emphasize Buddha's wisdom about how suffering occurs and how we create suffering over and over, and how we continue to create karma through our egotistic thinking. But Buddha's teachings also tell us how we can put an end to suffering and to karma. So I think the story of Buddha's effort is his biggest teaching. Maybe not so much in the words that he said, his effort. And when we follow his effort, our own effort becomes the foundation of how we end confusion and how we discover the natural way of life. As we know, or at least as we have heard over and over again, everyone is already Buddha, even though our human tendencies persist and habits and desires continue to arise. If we pay attention and acknowledge these harmful tendencies and know how to treat them, we become a Buddha. An example of this, I found an example of this in Crooked Cucumber, the book about Suzuki Roshi's biography. And in there, he talks about Kitano Roshi, who was at one point the Archbishop of the Soto Zen School and the Abbot of Heiji Monastery. Kitano Roshi. Kitano loved to smoke. He loved his cigarettes. And the story in A Crooked Cucumber tells about the day that Kitano Roshi went out with his fellow monks on a begging trip, like they did every week. And he sat down to take a break, pulled out a cigarette, and enjoyed it very much. And he felt such a deep enjoyment of his smoking that he decided this would be the perfect time to give up the smoking habit. In Crooked Cucumber, Suzuki Roshi is quoted as saying, although Kitano Roshi gave up smoking, he had the desire as long as he was alive, but he knew how to treat his desires. And he says, it is very foolish of you not to notice this point. And Roshi goes on to say, I know it is difficult to quit smoking. I don't say you should give it up. But if you know this point, you will know how to treat yourself, even though it is difficult. So that's a remarkable story. Kitano Roshi had a long habit of smoking and he enjoyed it. And at the very moment where he was enjoying smoking to its fullest, he said, now is the moment to give it up. That's very unusual. Most people say, this is so good, I'm going to do this again. He said, no, I'm going to give it up. I find that story to be very enlightening. The Buddha recognized how we human beings are easily captive to our desires. We keep repeating them. It's like never-ending cycle. And when we continually repeat our desires, it only results in a life of confusion. And this repetition is part of Buddha's teaching. You all may know the teaching of dependent origination, or the cycle of birth and death. It talks about how and why we humans are reborn and continue to suffer. It is based on the notion, or Buddha's understanding, that we suffer because we continue to be reborn. And it's this dependent origination, or the links in the chain of causation, that describes it. Causation being another word for being born again. The idea was, we enter nirvana by breaking the chain of continual rebirths. That teaching may not seem relevant to the world we live in today, but when we study dependent origination, we can learn something. It's recorded, I found it in one of the scriptures, Buddhist teachings, called the Digha Nikaya, or in English, the collection of the long discourses. So dependent origination, part of it says, feelings will lead to desire. Desire will lead to grasping. Grasping will lead to acquisition. Acquisition will lead to decisions, and so forth. And towards the end, it says, avarice will lead to guarding of possessions. And the guarding of possessions will lead to taking up the stick and sword, quarrels, disputes, arguments, strife, abuse, lying, and other unskilled states. So Buddha preached giving up guarding of possessions as the way to guard our mind from attachment and from suffering. And he preached about things and places to avoid, and encouraged monastic life. Most of us cannot disengage from society. We don't want to do that. We want to stay involved in society. So pursuing a monastic life is not something that we find attractive. It doesn't fit. It's not appropriate for our modern life. But it would be a good thing to do for a short time, if we can manage it. It's okay to disengage from society and enter monastic life for a short period. That experience can show us what it is that we can truly live without. Normally, we become accustomed to the things of our life that we collect and surround ourselves with, and makes us comfortable and feel secure. But there are many things about that way of life that we can live without. And when we experience monastic practice coming from a comfortable life, after some adjustment and difficulty, we will come to understand what comforts and privileges we should give up, what we can give up. And so in our time away from our daily life, when you spend a short time in monastic life, we learn to give up some of the things that we held so dearly. But eventually, we have to return to the world of people and the world of things. So our practice is about learning to live in harmony with the world of temptations, of material things and emotional things, to live in harmony with temptations without being seduced by them, without being deluded by them, and without being driven by them. This is how we learn to express the mind of Buddha. Does anybody have any questions? Oh, Dave.
Thank you for your talk, Les. So many things to think about and ponder. One thing that you touched on reminded me of something that happened quite a few years ago when a newcomer asked in the question period after your Dharma talk. I think you had touched on the notion of karma during the talk. And the newcomer said, so what is the attitude these days of Zen Buddhists about rebirth, reincarnation? And I believe I correctly remember you saying, well, we just don't really talk about that very much anymore. And I was reminded of that when I recently was talking to a Vietnamese friend who is a devout Buddhist, but not from the Zen tradition. And she just said very flat-footed, if you don't believe in reincarnation, then you can't be a Buddhist.
No.
So I was rather taken aback by that. I'm sort of more of the school of we don't really talk about that much anymore, but it certainly is woven through the history. I mean, one of my favorite Zen stories is the story of Hyakujo and the fox, which has a wonderful sort of punchline to it, but woven all through it is the idea of a Zen teacher who couldn't answer a key question being reincarnated as a fox for his failure. And I'm just wondering if you could sort of say a little bit more about the whole notion of how these days in the American Zen school, we look at this traditional notion in Buddhism of reincarnation and rebirth.
To put it simply, I don't think the old traditional view of reincarnation and rebirth computes in our culture. But it doesn't mean there's no such thing as rebirth. It's just, what is it that gets reborn? Buddhist scripture seems to tell us that this entity gets reborn in some form, that we come back over and over again, and that's the cause of suffering. But I think as we practice in the world we are in today, as we approach our practice with a bit of a different mindset, trying not to get too analytical, I think we see that what we try to prevent these days or to overcome is rebirth of delusion, rebirth of mistaken ideas, to give up rebirth of our foolishness. And this is what our practice is helping us do. It helps us see our foolishness, our habits, and we make a vow, I don't want to do that anymore. I'm not going to do that anymore. I'm not going to allow that delusion to be reborn. So I think our whole notion of the Buddhist teaching of rebirth is undergoing a change. It's accommodating to the world we live in, and not taking that traditional teaching so literally. Maybe it was taught that way by the Buddha thousands of years ago for a very good reason, which I wouldn't pretend to understand. But for today, what is meaningful for us is, let's not give rebirth to those things that create suffering and create confusion. And I think that's what we're doing. Thanks, Dave.
Thank you.
Travis.
Oh, Travis.
Hi.
I see the hand.
Your talk, Les. Thank you. A lot to sit through and think about. I was also just struck by how you were describing rebirth, and wanted to ask you if you thought that Suzuki Roshi's beginner's mind, or really even way of thinking how to be in the world, is also a continuous birth of attention in the present. That's a way to think about like a positive aspect of this rebirth, that, you know, is devoid of any delusion.
I don't recall Suzuki Roshi talking about any of that. He was much more down to earth and pragmatic. As far as I can remember, he never talked about dependent origination, which I referred to tonight as part of Buddha's teaching. Suzuki Roshi never went there. He always stayed with what's going on in the real moment.
Right.
In this moment.
So people sometimes would say, like, he really saw them, you know.
Yes.
And that's like how I'm thinking of this in that sense. Like if you show up for the moment and the people that are there and the situation that's occurring just as it is, that's a kind of birth to the present. And I think that in a way is like, it's sort of allegorical to rebirth, but I thought I would just ask you if you thought that was part of his teaching as well. Thank you.
You know, his teaching was about practicing with determination, seriously. And his teaching was about telling us what to avoid.
Mm-hmm.
He kind of let us know, these are some of the things that will get you into trouble. There's a famous moment where somebody said that he went to meeting with Suzuki Roshi, and Roshi said, this individual had a reputation of being an angry person. And Roshi said to him, you know, you can choose to be angry, but don't. Mm-hmm. I think many people have heard this story. I know, may know who I'm referring to, but that was the way he was. You know, you can be angry if you want to, that's your choice. But let me give you a clue, you know, try to get over that. Don't. Mm-hmm. So he was constantly pointing out in a very subtle way and a very kind way, the things that we did that caused us confusion or that continued, how our confusion continued. Mm-hmm. He would watch us carefully and he would subtly point out some tendency that we had. That's the way I remember him. That's the way I experienced him. But of course, it was so subtle that, you know, it was done in such a kind way that you didn't take it as a criticism.
Right.
That was his genius.
Like a tenderheartedness.
Yeah, he knew how and when to say certain things so that we would learn and feel okay. Mm-hmm. That's why everybody loved him. He was good at that. Thank you, Travis.
Thank you for sharing that, Les. Thank you for your talk.
Soto.
Yeah. Great talk, Les. So nice to see you. This thing about rebirth and reincarnation, all this, my reading about, you know, Anatman, you know, no self, no soul, seems to clarify the issue. It would be a very clear statement that there isn't anything that's to be reincarnated and overcome. And I think, I'm not sure about this, but it occurs to me that, you know, believing or having a doctrine of rebirth and needing to get over that to get rid of suffering is because it implies permanence. You know, reincarnation and rebirth, they have this implication of permanence, which, you know, a belief in permanence and a clinging to permanence is going to cause suffering for sure. I know I've experienced it. So I don't know why we're still having this debate about this when it seems pretty clear that at least the Buddha says flat out there's no separate individually existing objective entity called me. And it just seems that I believe, I'm not sure if this is true, but I had read somewhere that a lot of these things, like, you know, the Buddha taught this about reincarnation, rebirth, those things were written down a long, long time after Buddha died. He didn't, you know, that wasn't actually written down when he was alive. So, you know, I'm not so sure he actually said those things. So I don't know. I mean, what are your thoughts about that?
It's not unusual to be skeptical because the writing down the teachings didn't happen until writing was invented. So his teachings were carried on, you know, word of mouth for centuries. So, you know, we can be skeptical, that's okay. But our job is to, you know, explore the practice and the teachings with a new mind, with the mind with minds that are very alert and very active and very intellectual and know how to analyze and parse things. So I'm not sure we are in a debate right now. I think we're just trying to learn what these teachings mean for us today. Mm. You know, I think we're going through a process of discovery. Zen in the West is like, what, we're in what, our third generation now, second generation, less than 100 years. So we're still learning, and it's going to take a while. So let's go ahead, be confused, study our confusion and learn from it.
Yeah.
And then let's take joy in our effort and in sharing what we learn. I think let's not get too serious about it. We get
yes.
let's learn and share and go ahead. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you.
Hi, Diane.
Hi, Les.
Hi.
Thank you for your talk. It's funny that this is, you said you wanted to explore our practice, and it was such a beautiful talk, but I think we've all gotten hung up on this reincarnation and rebirth stuff, and it is the thing that popped into my head as well initially. And now with all the discussion, I really agree with, I'm used to calling you Don. Now are you Sodo? Sodo.
This happened, Diane, because there's another Zen center that and they want you to put up your Dharma name.
Oh.
Once you do it on one Zoom website, it's everywhere on every Zoom you go to. Okay. So that's why that happened.
But okay, all right. Anyway, I think what you said about there, if there's an abiding self and there is not an abiding self, then how can there be rebirth and reincarnation? So I agree with that. But I also think that how we practice and how we live and what we do lives on in a way and is reborn continuously. If we are evil and mean and possessive, or if we're kind and loving, I think that continues and is reborn in during our lives and beyond, in the people that we touch and the people that we interact with. So in that sense, I think some of what we have done and how we lived does live on. But in terms of actual rebirth or reincarnation and reaching certain levels in each reincarnation, it doesn't ring true for me, but of course we have the not knowing mind as well, don't we? So we just don't know. Anyway, thanks for bringing that up, Les, but your talk was much, much more than that, and I appreciate that. Thank you.
Diane, what you're really saying is, it's not a thing or a person that gets reborn; it's karma that gets reborn.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it seems that way. And do you think I think you're kind of saying that?
Yeah.
Is that true?
I think that's right.
Yeah. Yeah. Thank you.
Yeah. Oh, hi, Phil.
Hi, Les. Thank you for your talk. I enjoyed it. It reminded me of a very smooth globe that one looks for something to hold on to, or some way of coming into it in the sense of just, I don't know. It was beautiful. Anyhow, I enjoyed it. And I was thinking of what Travis said. What occurred to me immediately, if you don't use the metaphor of rebirth, Suzuki, in talking about Buddhist practice, uses the analogy of he wanted to find out how a sage becomes a sage, and or how bread becomes perfect bread. And he made it over and over again until he became quite good at it. And it seemed like that was also another kind of analogy that kind of resonated for me with what Travis was saying, and avoids the metaphor of the metaphysical kind of aspect of the term of rebirth. But there's just so many wonderful things about your talk. And again, it's like, it was smooth like a jewel. It didn't have rough edges. Thank you.
Thank you, Bill.
David.
Yes. Thank you for your talk, Les. It was very encouraging. I want to put in a word for compassion and understanding. I love the fact that the Kanando people are going to wrestle with the rebirth issue for a while. Now that the genie's out of the bottle, it's not going to go away. And you'll come to your own understanding of that. At the same time, keep in mind that the wide world of Buddhism, of which I have traveled just a tiny slice, has very strong orientation, a culture even, of a rebirth and many rebirths as part of larger Buddhism. And you will run into those people, so don't be surprised. And as always, keep a beginner's mind about it. Because the other, when I encountered it, I made a fool of myself. So when you encounter it, don't be too surprised and listen compassionately. Be my hope. Thank you.
Lee Umar.
Yeah. Lee Umar. Yes. So let's, what I got from your lecture was more along the lines of this birth and death and self and selflessness that we talk about in Buddhism. The way that I'm moving forward in my practice, and I'm seeing it more and more, it's more about moving towards the benefit of all. It's just not only the benefit of me, but benefit of everyone. And I keep coming back to this in my head over and over again. How can we do things that benefits everybody? It's just not, there's no selfishness here, but I think I can call it a bigger selfishness, which is just the selfishness for everybody. So that's what I was understanding from your lecture in a very simple way, taking care of things so that everybody benefits from it.
Good. Good. Thank you. That's a nice observation. Thank you. Mm. A nice, very nice sentiment.
Yeah.
Thank you. Yeah. You may?
Yes. I find out, actually, it's not me. It's thank you, Teresa. I'm going to share the screen. Sorry, I'm a host, so I have some power. So this is the fundamental statement of Kanado. Back in 1988. So when I heard this, to accord with true nature is a laughable idea. Yeah, just whatever, things passed. We might not step into the same river, but just anything you say, I love to hear. Thank you.
What?
I don't know. well, that's good that we laugh, right? So, to accord with true nature is a laughable idea. For some reason, it just, yeah. Love to hear anything from you.
No. Well, wouldn't you think that is something that we would want to do? to be in accord with true nature?
Yeah.
But this statement, who wrote this statement?
You.
Oh, no, no, no.
Oh, does it?
Did I?
Yeah.
Wow. Oh, I don't understand it.
Perfect. Thank you.
Thank you. I might have an understanding of that I think. I think it's probably referring to the fact that technically speaking, it's impossible to not be in accord with true nature. So, but we have to work at it. And in that sense, it could be considered laughable. But, you know, even being in a state of delusion is what our true nature is doing at that moment. And we work at freeing ourselves from that or getting disentangled from it also. So the combination of those things is a little bit laughable, maybe. Maybe that's what was meant. You know? But yeah. Otherwise, yeah, it's pretty mysterious.
Or Don, it can mean that in just enjoy your true nature and be happy. You know?
That's another way to look at it.
Simply for just means be happy. But when you find your true nature, enjoy it. You know, because each and every moment is enjoyable when you find your true nature. Yeah. Thank you.
Yeah, that's another good idea.
Well, such a enjoyable good. Night.
Good.
Any questions more? Oh, Dave. Woo! Dave, please.
Just very briefly, when we talk about laughter, I've been actually quite interested over the years in trying to understand what humor and laughter really is. And there are a number of theories about where it comes from, but they all point in the direction of a buildup of sort of dramatic tension and concern, which is then resolved in an unexpected way. And in some sense, I think that's part of the thread of Les's talk tonight, that we have our effort, and it feels a lot of times like what Suzuki Roshi would have called a gaining idea. And yet the real fruits of our practice arise in a way that's completely different from that, and fundamentally not something that can be rationally expected. And in that sense, it sort of resonates with this idea of what humor actually is. Anyway, that's my two cents for it.
Hey, thank you.
Thank you, Dave. Wow, really enjoyable night.
This talk was brought to you by the Canando Zen Meditation Center in Mountain View, California. For more information or to support this podcast, go to canando.org. That's K-A-N-N-O-N-D-O.org.